120. Then, in its 12th day aboard the International Space Station. In particular, it was directed at mission specialist Scott Pirozinski, a rare Star Wars fan among the few humans who've made it into orbit and beyond. His son, whom he had named Luke, was 10 years old at the time. He had been born around the time of the release of the special edition. "That was a great, great way to wake up," Pirozinski told Mission Control. Then, for his son, he performed the first known Darth Vader impression outside of planet Earth. "Luke, I am your father," he said. "Use the Force, Luke." As if the scene couldn't get any geekier, the shuttle that had transported the crew to the International Space Station had been carrying a special Star Wars payload. The very lightsaber Mark Hamill had used in Return of the Jedi. Space Center Houston officials had come up with the idea to fly it to commemorate the 30th anniversary of the original movie, and Lucas had readily agreed. The lightsaber had been delivered to NASA officials in a ceremony at Oakland Airport, with Peter Mayhew, the actor who played Chewbacca, handing it over. Flown from Oakland to Houston, the lightsaber was received by R2-D2 and stormtroopers from the Texas 501st. Lucas was on site, watching the shuttle launch that blasted his prop into space. That was NASA's greatest staged homage to Star Wars, but another, less intentional one occurred some 4 years later, in 2011, when the agency's astronomers used the Kepler telescope to discover, for the first time, a planet orbiting two suns. Officially, the planet was designated Kepler 16 ABB. Unofficially, astronomers at NASA and around the world gave it another name, Tatooine. This was something of a victory for Lucas. When Star Wars first came out, astronomers had declared it highly unlikely that a planet like Luke Skywalker's could exist so close to two suns. In the 2 years after Tatooine was discovered, another 19 double star system planets showed up. NASA was moved to offer an official apology to Lucasfilm. ILM's John Knoll, speaking on behalf of Lucas, accepted the apology. "The very existence of these discoveries caused us to dream bigger, to question our assumptions," he said. Or as Einstein put it, "Imagination is more important than knowledge. Sometimes, when you're just trying to make space fantasy, it turns out you can be accidentally ahead of the curve of science." George Lucas may have spent much of his career with his eyes fixed on the heavens, but in his post-Star Wars life, he would be preoccupied with more terrestrial, prosaic battles. On the domestic front, everything seemed blissful for Lucas in 2013, the closest a person can get, perhaps, to happily ever after. Retired at last, he wasted no time proposing in January to Melody Hobson. They were married in June at Lucas's own Never Never Land, Skywalker Ranch. Lucas's friend Bill Moyers was the officiant. Friends remarked, as they had remarked for a number of years, how much slimmer and happier Lucas seemed since he'd been with Melody, how much better dressed. The media were far from the gates of Skywalker, faked out by rumors that the wedding was going to take place in Chicago. Minimal press attention, an elite crowd, and a utopian setting, just the way Lucas likes it. And there was even happier news on the horizon. Melody and George were pregnant with a first biological child, Everest, via a surrogate. The world would not find this out until Everest was born in August. The following year, in May 2014, Lucas threw yet another Skywalker Ranch celebration, inviting far-flung friends such as Laddie and Fred Roos to celebrate his 70th birthday. But Lucas's first few years of retirement didn't go so well. This was especially true when it came to preserving and controlling his legacy. Sure, he built a nice park for his neighbors in San Anselmo, where he unveiled statues of Yoda and Indiana Jones, marking the icons that were created nearby, but his eyes were on the glittering prize of the Lucas Cultural Arts Museum. This was his legacy project, a vast and vastly expensive edifice in the Beaux-Arts style, near the gold-domed Palace of the Legion of Honor in the Presidio of San Francisco. It would make the San Francisco skyline look a little more like Naboo. It would be steps from the Disney Museum, where the life of the other creator to birth a globally admired mass entertainment was celebrated. The LCAM, as it was known, would contain all the storytelling art Lucas had been collecting, funding, and dreaming about since he was a child. Norman Rockwell and Maxfield Parrish jostling for space alongside Scrooge McDuck creator Carl Barks and exhibits on CGI. But Lucas hadn't counted on a couple of roadblocks on the way to the LCAM. The first one was called the Presidio Trust. This body of local grandees were appointed by the President of the United States to manage the national park, and as part of the deal, they had forged with Lucas back when he had moved Lucasfilm into the Presidio in 2005. The trust asked Lucas for a quid pro quo, that he would someday build a world-class cultural institution in the Presidio. When a retail chain called Sports Basement vacated a building down by the waterfront, in the shadow of the Golden Gate Bridge, it seemed a given that Lucas would take it over. This was prime real estate for a memorial to any global icon, let alone one who had taken San Francisco values, the U.S. military is an evil technological empire, corporations and bankers will destroy the Republic, and turned them into two trilogies of the most fantastic, world-conquering legend in history. But Star Wars itself was also a roadblock to the LCAM, in a way, and perhaps also to Lucas's dreams for his own legacy. Lucas once confessed to Disney's Bob Iger that he knew the first line of his obituary would read, "George Lucas, creator of Star Wars," no matter what he did, even if he sold the company, and that he had come to terms with that. Try as he might, Lucas couldn't shake the impression among certain concerned citizens of San Francisco that what he was building was essentially a Star Wars museum, one they feared would instantly become the most popular destination in the city and bring half the population of the world driving and tramping through their parkland waterfront. Despite the fact that Lucas had an agreement with the Presidio Trust to build the museum, not to mention a hand-picked board and millions in escrow waiting to pay for construction, the trust decided at the last moment to open the museum space up to a competition and extensive public debate. Nancy Bechtel, chair of the trust, was a well-to-do fourth-generation San Franciscan, the former chief financial officer of an international consulting giant, the president of the San Francisco Symphony, and a George W. Bush appointee. It's also fair to say that she was not a huge fan of Star Wars. Before he knew it, Lucas the billionaire, who was offering to fully fund the museum, found himself competing against a museum proposal from the National Park Service, which didn't have funding, but helps manage the Presidio, and has strong ties to Bechtel and the Trust. Lucas pulled political levers as adeptly as Chancellor Palpatine. He got the support of San Francisco mayors, past and present, both California senators. A letter of support was signed by 100 Star Wars-loving luminaries of Silicon Valley, from Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg to Steve Jobs' widow. After conveying his displeasure to her on a number of occasions, Lucas even got Democratic leader and San Francisco Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi to work the phones for the LCAM. Bechtel wasn't moved by any of this, so Lucas next tried a carrot-and-stick approach. The stick came first, in the form of a New York Times interview in which Lucas declared that the trust members hate us, and that his opponents' proposals were a jar of jargon. He also threatened to move the LCAM project to Chicago, Melody's hometown, where Rahm, Mayor Rahm Emanuel, was waiting to offer Lucas a space. The carrot came a few days later, at the only Presidio Trust meeting Lucas attended. Clearly nervous, he was still, as his sister said, a behind-the-scenes guy. He spoke haltingly about how the Presidio was the birthplace of digital arts, along with Marin County, he added quickly, and thus would be well-suited as the site of the museum. He apologized for using the word hate, a word he said he told his children not to use, but he couldn't help himself needling the trust over the broken deal. Plus, the idea of LCAM was to help fund the Presidio to, you know, pay the bills here, he said in conclusion. You never know, they might need the extra money. He sincerely wanted to inspire kids, to promote the digital arts, to celebrate the shared myth of storytelling, and to give his traveling Star Wars exhibits, of which there have been a good half dozen since 1993, a home near his home. But that was Lucas's closing argument for the museum. Cold, hard cash. After several meetings in which Presidio residents made their distaste for Lucas's proposal known, Bechtel announced that the trust had reached a unanimous decision. The prized real estate would go to none of the competitors and would be turned into parkland instead. But the trust still hoped Lucas would build a museum somewhere in the park. Lucas was furious. He was subsequently offered a much smaller plot of land close to the Letterman Digital Arts Center. And at time of this recording, he was investigating a spot for the museum on the lakefront in Chicago. Lucas had overcome every obstacle in his life. He had survived a crash that should have killed him. And he'd completed every creative project he ever set his mind to. He'd broken free of Hollywood. He'd made himself a millionaire and then a billionaire. He'd invested himself and his money and his passion and his research into his Flash Gordon fan project, pursuing perfectionism relentlessly until it exploded in a light show that burned itself into billions of imaginations. He'd built an empire out of the dreams that resulted, spun a century's worth of stories, tapped almost by accident into deep spiritual notions and mythologies, shattered our visual expectations, transformed the meaning of merchandise, and changed our perception of the universe forever. He'd accomplished so much, but when it came to building a suitable temple to house his vast legacy, George Lucas's plans were interrupted by not-quite-so-rich folks who didn't like new money, or at least, not the kind of new money that came from a popular space fantasy epic. Whatever one thought of Lucas's epic, by 2014, it seemed to be never-ending. The seventh episode in the trilogy was approaching, and Lucasfilm was maintaining an even greater, tighter, more maniacal level of secrecy than ever before. Not a detail about the film's contents, its cast, or even its shooting locations was to be leaked by anyone working on the production or even slightly affiliated with it. A Hasbro toy merchandising executive tweeted the fact of his visit to the set in Pinewood Studios, 20 miles west of London in February 2014. He didn't give away a single detail, but weeks later, his Twitter account was inexplicably deleted. Star Wars Movie Productions had been secretive before, but this was something else. It took Lucasfilm until March 2014 to reveal that the movie would be set 30 years after Return of the Jedi and would star a trio of new leads alongside some very familiar faces. And until May 2014 to confirm what Lucas had let slip in an interview more than a year earlier, that the familiar faces belonged to Mark Hamill, Carrie Fisher, and Harrison Ford, not to mention Anthony Daniels, Kenny Baker, and Peter Mayhew. When the company couldn't entirely suppress negative details, they were expertly buried in a slew of positive news. For instance, screenwriter Michael Arndt left the project under mysterious circumstances to be replaced by director Abrams and Lawrence Kasdan. Rumor had it that Arndt didn't like spending a lot of screen time on three very familiar faces and wanted to get straight to the trio of new leads. Abrams and his boss, Kathleen Kennedy, felt that more homage was due to the old crew. Lucasfilm managed to deflect stories about Arndt's departure by announcing a significant number of the movie's behind-the-scenes big names. It wasn't just Kasdan helping to create Episode 7 now, but also sound gurus Ben Burtt and Matthew Wood and composer John Williams, then 81. Social media rushed to fill the vacuum purposefully created by Lucasfilm. 1,000 amateur artists posted their ideal Episode 7 posters to Twitter and Facebook. So many popular tweets were posted speculating about the movie and its rumored stars that to cover them properly would require an entire other book. But for the most part, what fans and commenters contributed were Star Wars jokes, reflecting once again the franchise's propensity for loving spoofs. Comedian, actor, and Star Wars nerd Seth Rogen tweeted that Episode 7 should open with a line that suggested nothing at all had happened in the 30 years since Jedi. "Damn, those Ewoks can party! Now what?" Fellow comedian Patton Oswalt went Rogen one better. Appearing in an episode of Parks and Recreation on NBC, Oswalt was asked to ad-lib a filibuster for the show's town council meeting. What he came up with was over-the-top brilliance, an 8-minute rant filled with his nerdiest heart's desire about what should happen in Episode 7. It featured Wolverine and the other superheroes of the Marvel Universe, based on the principle that Marvel and Star Wars were both now owned by Disney. The Oswald ad-lib barely featured in the episode, but it found new life online, with 3 million YouTube views to date. The Nerdist channel added another million views simply for producing an animation of Oswald's storyline. Fans would likely burn down Disney HQ in Burbank if the company ever merged its franchises the way Oswald was proposing, but they couldn't get enough of his idea of Star Wars. Disney was, if anything, sealed up tighter than Lucasfilm when it came to details about the latest movie in the franchise. Several years out, Disney reps explained that this was a long-term and deliberate strategy. "We're just going to let Episode 7 speak for itself," one told me. Disney President Alan Horn, a recent transplant from Warner Brothers, spoke about Star Wars Episode 7 for the first time at CinemaCon, the annual confab of theater owners in Las Vegas, on April 17, 2013. It was the 40th anniversary of the day George Lucas had sat down to write the first full Star Wars treatment, though neither Horn nor Kathleen Kennedy was aware of that fact. That day, Star Wars fans were busy laughing at the Oswald video, which had been released that day, and also mourning the death of Richard Le Parmentier, who had passed the previous night. Le Parmentier was a fixture on the convention circuit, an actor known worldwide for a single scene on the Death Star. His character, Admiral Motti, is force-choked from across the room by Darth Vader. "Every time we find someone's lack of faith disturbing," Le Parmentier's family said in a statement, "we'll think of him." The theater Horn spoke in might as well have been an homage to Motti's workplace. If there was a screening room aboard the Death Star, it would have looked like the Colosseum, the $95 million theater at Caesar's Palace. Cavernous, black and red, boasts 4,298 seats, 120-foot ceilings, one of the largest indoor HD screens in the United States, and one of the largest stages in the world. While Horn addressed the CinemaCon attendees, red lights blinked just above the screen, which meant a system called Pirate Eye was scanning the audience and running the feed through algorithms aimed at detecting the outline of someone holding up a smartphone. An announcer told us, I was one of those being scanned, that security teams with night vision goggles would be patrolling the crowd throughout the presentation. I hoped Disney had hired the 501st Legion to do this job, but it turned out the company doesn't have that kind of sense of humor when it comes to piracy. Horn, who was mostly there to sell theater owners on the forthcoming and future flop, The Lone Ranger, seemed relatively uninterested in talking about the Star Wars franchise. 15 minutes passed before he told a folksy story about visiting Lucasfilm HQ in the Presidio for the first time. "It's not uncommon for someone at the end of a meeting to say, 'May the Force be with you.' Well, what do you say to that?" I said, "And also with you, my brother." A smattering of laughter came from the owner-filled audience, not quite the old cusses with their big cigars that Charlie Lippincott remembered, but clearly the descendants of that bunch. Later, Horn mentioned that Disney was going to release one Star Wars movie each year, with spin-off movies coming in between the episodes. Despite online rumors to the contrary, the spin-off movies would not be based around well-known Star Wars characters. This was not news to anyone paying attention. Iger revealed that schedule when he bought Lucasfilm, but Horn was the first to use the words "every year." The pens of every journalist in the room started moving on notebooks. Stories were posted online within the hour. The relationship between Horn and Kathleen Kennedy, his direct report, is still shrouded in mystery. But we do know that the release date of Episode 7 was a bone of contention. That day in April 2013, Horn announced that Episode 7 would be released in summer 2015. But Kennedy wasn't so sure. "We'll see," she said through gritted teeth on the red carpet at CinemaCon that night, when I asked her if that seemed likely. As it turned out, the date would be pushed back to December 18, 2015. The release date wouldn't be the only thing that Kennedy slashed. The LucasArts game division was laid off in its entirety in 2013, and its unfinished, highly anticipated game Star Wars 1313 was banished to the same shelf where the Underworld TV show on which it was based also sat unproduced. Clone Wars was canceled in 2013, the show's fans assuming that Disney didn't want a show that was screened on a rival subsidiary, Cartoon Network. With every bout of bad news, fans laid the blame at Disney's doorstep, without considering the fact that Lucasfilm had a new and steely Hollywood-based boss named Kennedy. It was no longer under the wing of a benign billionaire dispensing bags of cash to his passion projects. Star Wars simply didn't have the financial backing it once enjoyed. With a slew of new movies for which to budget and an expensive Hollywood director to fund, the budget of roughly $2 million per Clone Wars episode was simply not viable given the ratings. In the end, the decision to cancel that series, at least, came down to money. Kennedy wasn't down on the idea of televising Star Wars, though. She may have decimated the animation group, but she retained animation supervisor Dave Filoni and his key talent. She arranged for the remaining Clone Wars episodes to be polished and placed on Netflix, and Filoni's second animated TV series, which arose from the ashes of Clone Wars, looks to be simultaneously cheaper and better than its predecessor. Star Wars Rebels, Filoni's new show on the Disney XD channel, is still under wraps as of this recording. Difficult to see, as Yoda says. Always in motion is the future. Rebels is set 14 years after the events of Episode 3, and 5 years before the events of the original Star Wars. It stars a motley group of anti-imperial youths on the planet Lothal, recently occupied by the Empire. Kanan Jarrus, voiced by Freddie Prinze Jr., stars as a moody renegade Jedi who escaped the Order 66 massacre. The crew of his ship Ghost consists of Ezra, Zeb, Sabine, Hera, and the grumpy astromech droid Chopper. There's a Jedi-hunting Inquisitor after Kanan, and it doesn't take a Star Wars genius to guess which tall, black-armored, masked man in a cape is the Inquisitor's boss. This is ripe, virgin territory in the Star Wars universe, the height of the Empire and the rise of the Rebel Alliance. It's the same period Underworld was supposed to cover. Not even the expanded universe touched this period much, a hangover from the fact that Lucas was reserving all the time in his galaxy prior to Episode 4 for the prequels. As if to signal the old-school original trilogy fans that it's safe to come back, Filoni based all his concept art for Rebels on the paintings and sketches of that prime posse member, the man without whom Star Wars would not have been made, Ralph McQuarrie. When Filoni revealed the first batch of concept art from Rebels at Celebration Europe in July 2013, he did so surrounded by a squadron of 501st Legion members dressed not as the stormtroopers we know exactly, but as the McQuarrie concept versions, back when the space soldiers carried laser swords. Ralph's designs are as real a part of Star Wars as anything that existed on screen, gushed Filoni. Kennedy sees the work of the writers and the artists to whom George Lucas has passed the torch, whether on Rebels, Episode 7, or the first of many spin-off movies, as inviolate, paramount, beyond the control of any corporate strategist or marketing executive. Imagination drives innovation, Kennedy told fans in Germany in 2013, before drawing wild applause for suggesting that Episode 7's special effects would use models and puppets as much as CGI. We're going to use every single tool in the toolbox to create the look of these movies, she said. And this was confirmed the following year when Abrams filmed a charity video from the Episode 7 set in Abu Dhabi. It was quite deliberately interrupted by a giant puppet that looked like it had wandered in from Dark Crystal. Discussing how unnamed other big-budget movies had lost their way, she added, "If you don't pay attention to the foundation of these stories, and spend the time you need to find unique stories, complicated stories, after a while the audience gets tired." Kennedy's most important contribution to the future of Star Wars was to found the Lucasfilm Story Group in 2012. This shadowy organization is led by Kiri Zuperhart, a writer, producer, and veteran of the Ladd Company and Kathleen Kennedy's production outfit. It consists of Leland Chi, keeper of the Holocron, plus representatives of the licensing group, brand communications team, and Business Strategy Department. Their main day-to-day task is to coordinate between all of this new Star Wars content bursting onto our screens and to lay down the law on what can and can't be done. In other words, to approximate Lucas's intentions in the absence of Lucas. More importantly, the story group moved aggressively to retire the expanded universe. No longer would the holocron contain a confusing division between movie canon, TV canon, book and comic book canon, and the lowest form of content, S-canon. There would only be the story group's stamp of approval, and everything else would be rebranded Star Wars Legends, effectively banished to the universe of It Never Really Happened. In May 2014, the story group's decision was announced. Nothing had the stamp of approval except the 6 movies, plus the Clone Wars. This was a power not even George Lucas dared wield. The power to cull everything that has ever been said or written about the galaxy far, far away into a single, coherent, Lucasfilm-approved narrative. Star Trek, the Marvel and DC superhero universes, all of these long-running franchises have had moments when the sheer amount of content spun out of control and started to contradict itself. Their custodians were forced to start all over again in an alternate universe, in effect, the dreaded moment known to fans as a reboot. What the story group did was more an extremely drastic series of amputations. Star Wars authors would have loved to not be considered part of the infected limb. In 2013, Timothy Zahn pointed out to me, rather hopefully, that all of his books fit in the years between episodes 4 and 7. They didn't have to be wiped out, he said, because they don't affect the future trajectory of the franchise. But Zahn fell into line soon enough and was quoted in the Expanded Universe killing announcement praising Lucasfilm for its vast canvas. The power to determine what gets painted where on that canvas has, in effect, been handed to a Star Wars fan. He's probably the most knowledgeable leader of the story group, and his job is to know and help steer everything about the future content of the saga. Every movie, every game, every TV show, every book. A scary smart superfan who wrote the book on Star Wars books and effectively explained Star Wars intellectual property enough to satisfy Disney. A man who, if Star Wars is around 100 years from now, may well be responsible for the fact. A guy who is living the fanboy dream. Pablo Hidalgo. Pablo Hidalgo, 39, is original Star Wars generation. He claims to have been spurred into his career because he was belittled for not drawing TIE fighters right at the age of 4. Born in Chile and raised in Canada, Hidalgo read the 1979 Star Wars novel Han Solo at Star's End until the pages began to fall out. In the mid-1990s, he started writing for the Star Wars role-playing game. In 2000, he was snapped up by Lucasfilm as an internet content developer and moved to California. Within a year, he was managing editor of StarWars.com and much more besides. "He wrote more of the Star Wars encyclopedia than I did," admits Steve Sansweet. In 2011, Hidalgo became brand communications manager. In other words, Lucasfilm's explainer-in-chief, a rare example of a total nerd who speaks mainstreamese. Hidalgo was the guy Lucasfilm tapped to help explain the Star Wars franchise to Disney before they bought it. In a similar feat in August 2013, he gave an hour-long version of his presentation to Disney's fan conference, D23, at the airy Anaheim Convention Center, steps from the original Disneyland. It's called Crash Course in the Force. First, addressing the Star Wars fans rather than the Disney fans in the audience, Hidalgo acknowledged that intense speculation had been raging over Episode 7. "I can reveal exclusively," he said, pausing for dramatic effect, "that that's not what this panel's about." He laughed. "Let's pause for all the bloggers to walk out of the room. If you've got your smartphone out, you can relax." I was laughing until I noticed that a sizable number of people, maybe 100, were actually walking out. This is Hidalgo, at once the consummate Lucasfilm insider and utterly savvy about today's social media networked, blogging on hyperspeed culture. His mind can encompass the 17,000 characters that appear in Star Wars novels. He wrote the comprehensive 2012 guide, The Essential Reader's Guide to the Star Wars Universe. He is known for documenting every appearance in Lucasfilm movies of an old sound effect from the 1950s favored by Ben Burtt called the Wilhelm Scream. But he can talk with ease and poke an affectionate kind of fun at fandom at the same time. The previous day at D23, when Bob Iger had told a crowd of thousands that he was speechless, and I'm going to remain speechless, about everything Lucasfilm, his remark had been met with boos. Earlier that day, when Alan Horn had repeated his stump speech about visiting the Lucasfilm campus, "And also with you, my brother," some in the audience had laughed, but still, Horn got booed, both in person and on Twitter, for moving on without discussing Lucasfilm product. "I'm sorry," he said. "I wish I could say more. It will come soon." Some major newspapers reported the boos as news. Disney's communications department flew into a rage. Hidalgo's response to all this? Posting this dry tweet after his talk to a capacity 3,000-person crowd, "Heads up. No Star Wars announcements scheduled for the California Dental Association Convention, 8/15 through 8/17. Don't bother searching for the post. In February 2014, overwhelmed by how much of a time suck it was, Hidalgo left Twitter and deleted his widely followed account. In his Crash Course on the Force, Hidalgo admitted that there are numerous entry points for explaining what Star Wars is about. His way is not to introduce George Lucas, nor even to talk about Episode 4. "Star Wars is about Jedi Knights," he said, bringing pictures of multiple Jedi up on the big screen behind him. "Guardians of peace and justice. Also, we..." There's a Freudian pronoun. "Own one of the coolest weapons known to the galaxy, the lightsaber." "Any lightsabers here in the audience?" Hundreds of many-colored fluorescent sticks wave in the air. "Star Wars," Hidalgo added, "is also about the conspiracy by Sith lords to bring down the Jedi." He got audience members with red Sith lightsabers to wave theirs. "These are bad folks," he said, "not team players." The Sith kept losing, he explained, because they kept fighting each other. So one of them decided it was just going to be a conspiracy of two, and they retreated into the shadows. Finally brought down the Jedi, subverted democracy, and created the Galactic Empire. Someone cheered. "We've got a very sinister individual here applauding oppression and tyranny," laughed Hidalgo. "Star Wars is about the rebellion against that empire. It's about soldiers. You can't have a war story without soldiers," Hidalgo said. "Then there are the scoundrels." The audience erupted in cheers as Han Solo and Lando Calrissian appeared on the screen. "They could care less about intergalactic battles, Sith lords, Jedi, whatever. They're just trying to survive and make a buck." Then Hidalgo outlined the first six films, running through them not in the order in which they were released, but rather in the order of their internal chronology. "Let's start with Episode 1, Phantom Menace," he said, which elicited disgruntled murmurs from the crowd. A picture of Jake Lloyd got Hidalgo his first proper boo. He pressed on, showing how Anakin's growing up story contrasts with the fall of the Republic and ultimately causes it. Then he reached Episode 4, which for many of us is also the first movie. The audience cheered, with a palpable sense of relief. The folks I spoke to afterwards were uneasy with what Hidalgo was doing, putting the three weakest and most recent movies first, reordering the history of Star Wars as the public encountered it. In this, Hidalgo was simply following the guidelines laid down by the creator of the franchise before his departure. Star Wars is a single 12-hour saga that covers the tragedy of Darth Vader in chronological order. Still, what Hidalgo said next is very telling and beautifully phrased. "You might call it the best description of fandom's idea of Star Wars yet to emerge from Lucasfilm. As Star Wars fans will tell you, it's not about what happens. It's how the stories are told, with exquisite detail and texture," he says. "It's set in a universe that's very convincing. You can believe it's real. It has a history. It's lived in. It's alive. It's a place you want to revisit again and again," Hidalgo went on to rhapsodize, about the mind-blowing visuals and kinetic high-speed action sequences, exquisitely edited, and stepped into Joseph Campbell territory by describing Star Wars archetypes that reach back into our collective history as storytellers. But then, he brought it all down to earth. It's not so deep and mythic that it's not accessible. It's about human characters, human emotions, human relationships. It's stuff we can relate to. Friendship, camaraderie, love. Star Wars isn't afraid to have fun. In addition to telling deep stories and dark stories, it finds humor in character and circumstance, and sometimes in the most unexpected places. I mused on what Hidalgo had said as I walked back into the Anaheim sunshine, past costumed Disney fans wearing Chewbacca-themed backpacks. I took pictures of a sleeping beauty arm-in-arm with a Princess Leia, and noted more Darth Mickey caps than I'd seen that morning. I checked in on Facebook and Twitter, and saw more Star Wars products and memes filling my feeds than ever. I saw fan art with Darth Maul dressed as the Joker from Batman. I saw a photo of a Star Wars-themed crib with "I am a Jedi like my father before me" painted on the wall between two lightsabers. I saw BBC news readers dressed up as Boba Fett and a stormtrooper to celebrate news of an open casting call for Episode 7. Planet Star Wars certainly isn't afraid to have fun. Had Kathleen Kennedy done it, I wondered. Had she steered Lucas's Rebel Alliance of a company to safety, hidden in plain sight under the protection of a giant benign media empire? Had she tapped exactly the right person, a fan who defined and defended the idea of Star Wars more precisely than its creator could, to control the overarching structure of its future? Had that fan grasped the basic principles that would unite the fandom fractured by the prequels? Words that spoke for all the Star Wars generations? In the history of Star Wars, 2013 and 2014 will go down as landmark years. A new conductor was tapping her baton, calling for a moment of quiet and reflection before summoning up a new symphony with a new melody but familiar themes. Lucasfilm's silence during this spell, its distinct lack of content between Clone Wars and Rebels, was all part of a greater plan. Suspense and speculation have always been good off-screen complements to Star Wars movies. Only in 2014, fans weren't wondering how Han was going to get out of that carbonite, or whether Luke really was Vader's son. We were wondering about every single last detail of the movie to come. It was a silence in which to contemplate the pure idea of Star Wars, the richness, the possibility, and the endless expanse of the universe itself. The moment would come soon enough when the uncertainty wave collapsed, and we found out whether Schrödinger's cat was alive or dead in its box. Kennedy's canniness, Hidalgo's knowledge, J.J. Abrams' experience, all of these could yet conspire to produce a turkey. Difficult choices about the directions of a limitless franchise would have to be revealed. When they were, a world of fans lay in wait, preparing to pick apart every detail. At least one Star Wars fan predicted stormy weather ahead. "It's a complicated cultural icon," George Lucas said in 2013, when asked about his advice for Kennedy and Abrams. "You're always going to be in trouble, no matter what you do. So the best thing you can do is just plow forward and try to do the best story you can." In private, he urged Kennedy and Abrams to remember that the movies worked best when they were both aspirational and retained a sense of humor. But we won't know for sure whether the franchise's new stewards have told that best of all possible stories, not until that glorious and terrifying day in 2015, when we've all filed, finally, into a packed theater filled with excited murmuring and plastic lightsabers. The house lights will dim, and an electric cheer will go up. Some version of "When You Wish Upon a Star" will play incongruously over a Lucasfilm logo. The screen will go black. Then up will come 10 familiar words in blue. "A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away." Then silence. Blackness again. Then an orchestra will explode in B-flat major, and the largest logo you've ever seen will fill the entire screen. And no sooner has it appeared than it will immediately begin to recede, slipping away, pulling back into the stars, as if daring you to give chase. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of How Star Wars Conquered the Universe, The Past, Present, and Future of a Multi-Billion Dollar Franchise by Chris Taylor. Copyright 2014 by Chris Taylor. Performed by Nick Podell. Directed by Ken Schmidt. Engineered by Adam Tatro. Performance copyright 2014 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brilliantaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.